Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, we cover so many fun topics on this show, and I think one of the most interesting for many people, maybe for you, is a show we do on insects. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I think the world of insects is always interesting, and we have two experts for you today. First, entomologist Phil Pelletieri, who's been on the show how many times, Phil?
We're up in about the 460s, we think. 450s.
450, 450 times, something like that. So he knows what he's doing. P.J. Leish knows what he's doing, too. He took over the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab when Phil retired, and he's been involved with the Master Gardener Program, the first detector network. He's an instructor in the pesticide applicator training and UW Farm and Industry Short Course. Keeps you busy, PJ. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
Really great to have you along. When did you take over for Phil?
Technically, Phil had retired a year ago in February, so I started in the diagnostic lab on an interim basis March 1st. I was given the permanent position last July, so it's coming up just on a year already. Time flies.
Wow. And what are your favorite parts of the job? What do you like best?
Probably the best part is getting to see all the neat critters that come in, all the digital images and samples and insects that I've read about in books but haven't seen them, and all of a sudden someone mails me a sample and or sends me some digital images, and it's great to see them.
Yeah, very cool. And you recently wrote an interesting blog about insects that can emit a smell, and the purpose of emitting that smell is to get rid of other people, or what is it to do?
So there's all kinds of insects out there that emit smells, and a lot of the time it has to serve a defensive purpose. So they might be trying to deter a predator from eating them. But the particular blog post that I wrote was focusing on a critter we call citronella ants, which I know Phil has talked about many times before on the show, and it's a species of ant that lives in the soil, and occasionally they might be living beneath the concrete slab in someone's basement, and this time of year, if it's warm enough, they can pop out and start flying around, and it's essentially swarmers, so they're not going to hurt anything, but they have a very distinctive citronella lemony smell to them.
It's a great smell, and as you look around, I mean, there are insects all over the world. I know they're in the tropical areas. There are some that are pretty cool, too.
Oh, certainly.
That can smell up a storm if they have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the list just goes on and on. I mean, there are a number of stink bugs out there that have scent glands and can emit some rather foul-smelling chemicals. A common one we can see this time of year is the western conifer seed bug, which often likes to sneak in, hoping to find a place to hunker down for the winter, and they feed on seeds from conifers. And so their scent somewhat resembles a pine or a turpentine-like smell.
Yeah, there's some ground beetles. What are they, vivid and...
Oh, there's all kinds
metallic
of...
metallic ground beetles.
Yeah, all kinds of ground beetles. And if you were to catch one and put it in a small container and you come back the next day because you forgot about it and you open the lid and, wow, there are all kinds of smells that insects can emit.
And even bed bugs, eh?
Yeah, there is a subtle kind of a musty... I've even heard it described as a coriander-like smell that can be associated with bed bugs.
And carrion beetles is probably that'd be one of the worst, I would
think. Yeah, so carrion beetles get their name because they're feeding on carrion and dead animals. And so if you were to catch one and pick it up, there's a chance that you're going to get some nasty, foul-smelling chemical on your hand.
Oh, and Phil, any insects that come to your mind about...
Well, I mean, even the Asian lady beetle, you know, the body fluids that it exudes have a very distinctive odor, you know, and again, it's a defense mechanism, and so you tell people, I got to be a little careful picking certain insects up because they might give you a nip. Well, you have to be a little careful picking other ones up because, as I said, they may leave a little stain or a little present on your hand that, again, usually is pretty pungent.
Talking with Phil Pelletieri and P.J. Leish today about the bugs that smell and other bugs as well. Oh, hey, I even rhymed that one. You can join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you've got a bug that you have a question about. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org. Or you can post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post your comments there. BJ, I know there was a book that kind of got you interested in this whole area. Thomas Eisner, was it?
Yep. So back when I was in college, I was getting interested seriously in insects, and there's a book by Thomas Eisner called Secret Weapons, and that kind of sealed the deal. And it talks about all kinds of cool chemicals that insects and spiders and millipedes and centipedes can secrete as defensive weapons, essentially, to protect them from being fed on and preyed upon by other critters. So just a fascinating book.
It does sound pretty interesting. And I'm sure, Phil, you've looked at that book as well.
Sure. Well, you know, and Thomas was a chemist, but he just found so many unique chemicals and insects and
within
spiders.
Insects,
and so he spent a lot of his career. And plus, one of my favorite quotes, he's the one that quoted the term, it's time we make peace with the landlords. And he's talking about the insects and giving one a perspective that, indeed, no matter what we come up with, the insects are really still in control of this system.
Now, yeah, here we were in the middle of winter, and a friend said, I went to get my lunch bag out. It was been over the weekend, and, you know, I hadn't used it, and went to get her lunch bag out, and here it was full of ants.
Aha.
So now, where in the devil, she said, where do they come from? And I said, well, I have no idea where they came from. What did they look like? You know, she said, oh, I don't know. They were ants.
Well, this time of the year, there's only one explanation that they have to be nesting in the house because it's too cold. And we see carpenter ants. We see pavement ants are the two more common ones, I think. And in fact, PJ, I would think you'd probably getting the carpenter ant calls just about now. I know I've heard a couple rumbles at the Garden Expo. So
yeah, a couple have been trickling in. And I guess the thing with the ants in the house, if it's a case where you look in a lunchbox and you find the nest, that's an easy situation because everyone's home and you can take care of it pretty easily. It's when they're hiding elsewhere in the house, it gets a little trickier.
Yeah, I think those ants went right outside, so they got... I'm not sure that she got them all, but at least a goodly number of them got a rude shock to their system because kind of cold these days in Wisconsin, so I don't think they survived. Sally in Superior has a question for you guys. Hi, Sally.
Hi. I was wondering here, I had heard on the garden show, but I didn't write it down, of course, there's a chemical that you can spray on your clothes to keep ticks off, and I don't know if it kills them, but I know it keeps them off, and it seemed to be there that it was good for 2 weeks, that you could spray it just on your clothing.
Yeah, I mean, the product, I think what confuses people is that most of us associate the DEET product that's made for mosquitoes, and that is a repellent.
Right.
And although it could be put on the clothing, the product that's usually recommended, because I think it's more effective, is the permethrin product, which is a... an insecticide that is not registered for your skin in this use.
Right. Okay. Can you spell that for me?
The active ingredient is permethrin.
Okay, you lost me here. P-E-R-M...
T-H. Permethrin. P-E-R-M-E-T-H.
P-R-E-M. P-H.
T-H-R-I-N.
T-H-I-O-N. Okay.
R-I-N.
Right. And so you'll see this as a clothing spray, usually in sporting goods stores. It's a little harder, I think, to find in drug stores and the like.
Okay, how about a garden store?
Maybe not. As I said, it's a product line that more campers and people that hunt and spend a lot of time outdoors would be inclined to use. Okay. And depending on the formulation, some of the formulations will last far more than 2 weeks. What really I gets, if you wash things, you have to reapply. And so the labels will usually suggest to spray it when the clothing is not on your person and then put it on. But although it's sold as a repellent, if the tick walks, it shall die. And so that's, I think, where the efficacy is so much better with that product.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, because my husband got bitten by a tick that now has caused him to have a meat allergy.
Whoa. We'll let PJ handle that one because this is an ongoing new story for us.
Oh, interesting. What about that, PJ?
There is a relatively new species of tick in the state called the Lone Star tick. And we've known about it for a couple of years now, but it's more of a southern species. So places like Missouri and Arkansas and Tennessee is where we typically find this species. But, as I said, we've noticed it up in the state last couple of years, and it has this unusual kind of quirk in that some people that are bitten by it can develop an allergy to red meats. It has to do with a substance in the saliva of the tick.
Boy. Yeah, that would be a bummer.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. The doctor up here, we went to Duluth, which we're close to Superior, and we went to an allergist in the Duluth clinic, and he said he has two other people that have it, and it's very rare up here, and he's wondering, you know, how come it's coming up here, too.
The question, have you guys traveled much in the last couple of years?
We don't travel at all. Okay. I mean, Rice Lake is as far as we go.
Okay, because, although historically we always had just kind of a trickle, a record here, record there, and we figured that the ticks were just hitchhikers. But Dr. Paskowitz in the entomology department and her students pretty much, if confirmed, we're having them breed, I think, in the southern, I would say the southern third of the state maybe, but getting up your way, that's kind of extending the range, although... You know, the frustration, I think, with a lot of this stuff is it can be going for a while before it gets people's attention. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we thought maybe it hitchhiked on a bird or something.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar enough if a single tick bite will do it or it takes multiple tick bites. I know the whole unraveling of this story is fascinating because it had to do with a cancer drug and everything else. And so I think people kind of stumbled across it rather than, because that's a weird association that, weeks, months later after your tick bite, you develop an allergy, and trying to trace it back is not, as I said, really is quite fascinating.
So what's the cancer side of this? Do you know that backstory? Or?
Well, it was a cancer drug that was in trial, and they had this large group, and then all of a sudden this allergy came up, and so they were wondering, was it associated with that? But then there was the association with the tick bite, and that's how they started to put the puzzle together. But as I said, it was more stumbled across than anything else.
Wow. Sally, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Okay, and that's called permethrin.
Right.
Permethrin.
Right, which is a synthetic version of the natural pyrethrin. And the reason that the natural pyrethrin is not used in that manner is it degrades too quick to be that effective.
So it's P-E-R...
M-E-T-H-R-I-N.
There we go. Thank you, Sally. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri and P.J. Leash here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now we're having a lot of fun talking with P.J. Leash and Phil Pelletieri about the world of insects. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Don't forget, if you have a photo of an insect and you want to post that up on our Facebook page, I've got the page up, and we can take a look at it and help you out if we can. Mary in Menominee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I was just wondering, my dog and myself got bit by what I believe is a Lone Star tick. They're brown with a dark spot in the center. We live on a wildlife area, so I've got like a big jar of ticks that we got off of us from last year. They are in this area, though.
Yes, although I'm sure PJ would be happy to take a look if you want to ship them down and the like. I mean, the distinctive thing is this white spot in the back that is just a dot in the adult ticks. Now, our wood ticks and the deer ticks, and occasionally there's a couple other ticks we see come in. So we'd like to see them. In fact, one of the fascinating things I was interested in. Last year, so many people were asking us the effect of the winter it was going to have, and although we, I guess, didn't expect a whole lot, the one critter that I was really curious to see if it survived the winter was Lone Star tick, because, again, it's been extending its range. We think that's because of lack of winter, and so when PJ got his records of this last year, indeed, I think you had Brown County and Dane and a couple others.
Yeah, not too many sites in the state. I'd say only maybe three, four cases.
Right. And those so kind of southern part of the state.
Right, but we love to get those special specimens just because, as you said, that allows us to verify, get some historical reference to go with. So, as I said, if you still got the ticks, we'd be happy to take a look, and then we could tell for sure if it was or wasn't.
Okay, yeah, we have a jar, and we kept them in alcohol because we had numerous problems with us, and we thought, and I still have a bullseye on my leg that won't leave.
That's something different, isn't it?
Well, I mean, sometimes locally, especially if a tick burrows in pretty good, you can get a localized reaction that, you know, it's like any scar. It's hard to heal. And as I said, it'd be worth it. I mean, because historically, you know, we've liked to help people out with looking at ticks, both to verify, was it our American dog tick, which we all call wood ticks, or a deer tick, because that has, you know, that's important to know as far as potential diseases. The other thing is, under the scope, we can tell if the tick had been feeding roughly long enough to be an issue, because the thing with most of the diseases, it takes a couple days. And so if the tick was just crawling and just starting, the good news is you've got nothing to worry about. So that's why it is important to save the tick. And as I said, if complications come up, then you can kind of verify, and I think it helps the physicians out.
The way to tell for sure, if you do still have those around, you're welcome to ship them into my lab, and I'd be happy to examine them under the microscope.
Okay, great. Yeah, there's over 100 in the jar, so.
Okay, that'll keep me busy.
We were bit every which way last year.
Oh, my.
That winter did not stop them at all.
My goodness. Well, Mary, I'm glad I'm not living right where you are, to be perfectly honest. But thanks a lot for calling.
So we're constantly removing stuff.
Oh, man. Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Jim in Colfax, turn to you next. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, gentlemen. All right. I don't want you to think I'm bugs, because that's not the case, but I have a friend that is bugs. He's got little bugs that are coming out of his skin. They burrow out of the skin. Some of them are translucent. Now, I've seen them, but I didn't necessarily see them. I'd probably prefer getting a magnifying glass or a microscope or something on them, which we're going to do, but we're trying to get an idea of what they are. And so they're very little bitty. They're not scabies for what we can tell, but they're coming. He literally will take out the point of a knife and pick it out of the skin, and they're very itchy. They also, a couple of them look like they're like little woolly bears or like little centipedes in a way. But they're so small that there's nothing to go by to know what they are. Do you have any ideas?
Well, I'm not aware of any insects that'll burrow into skin like that. So especially this time of year, we start looking at other things. Can there be some other causes of skin reactions? If it were a warmer season, we can have a few things that will get on your skin and perhaps bite. You know, mosquitoes and ticks, we think of those right away. But in terms of things burrowing into the skin, I just don't know of anything that does that. We do have a critter called scabies, which is a very small microscopic mite, which can cause some skin rashes. But that's a type of thing where, in cases with that critter, you need to go into a physician and have them do a skin scraping to confirm that that might be the culprit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that, you know, when you have irritations and you start picking at them or whatnot, you can get a lot of things turn out in many cases are skin, you know, other things. And the other side of it is so often there's other kinds of problems that present like you think it's insects, but it's not. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. bacterial infections, those kind of things. And so often if you have those kind of irritations, it's worth seeing a dermatologist because they'll pick it up if it's scabies. They'll do the skin scraping. But as I said, allergies and other things that can cause reactions that look like insect bites and the sensations and the like, and so it's worth checking out. But as I said, this time of the year, it's easy to kind of eliminate because we just don't have those kind
nothing
of
nothing out
parasites.
There. Yeah. So a dermatologist is what you'd recommend.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could start with a family physician if you can get in quicker. I think the problem people have with dermatologists sometimes is it takes a few weeks to get to see somebody, and of course, if you want a quicker relief. But I think you follow up on the medical side because, as I said, physicians will pick it up. And it's also walking kind of an interesting line, although we deal with insects. When it gets to be on and in a person, that is technically a medical problem. And so, as I said, we can't speak to that. And that's why, you know, PJ doesn't do the skin scrapings. That's usually done in a hospital lab.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Jim, good luck with that. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give others a chance to join in. By the way, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. email us at talk@wpr.org and post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post there as well. We'd love to hear from you and John in the town of Dunn. We're hearing from him right now. Hi, John.
Good morning. I have a question that has to do with spiders. The question is, do spiders hibernate over the winter, or do they lay eggs in the fall and then the spider dies and the eggs hatch in the spring, or how does that work?
Yeah.
So it turns out we have an awful lot of different spider species, John, and they're all a little bit different. You go out in winter and let's say you were out in the woods and you saw some dead trees with loose bark, if you pry that bark off, you can often find a lot of spiders just hanging out for the winter. And if you were to bring them indoors and warm them up, they'll start wandering around. But as I said, each one's a little different. There will be some species that can overwinter as adults. Some may be overwintering more as young or as eggs. So unless you're looking at a particular species of spider, they're all a little bit different.
Okay, I think of the ones that are in the house. Probably they all look like various kinds of daddy long legs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a common one we get indoors is called a cellar spider, and it looks very much like a daddy long legs. It has thin, kind of very gangly legs.
Yeah.
And a small body with two main segments on the body. And those, because they're indoors in a habitat that is warm, you know, they can just kind of keep going all year round.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We had an email from Joe in Washburn. He says, well, it was 8 below 0 up here in Lake Superior. I brought in a load of 2-year-old firewood and fired up my stove. Noticed my cat's head circling, and within a few minutes, I was stung by a mosquito. Did I bring that little critter out of dormancy? Is this common?
You know, PJ and I were at Garden Expo this weekend, and I think I had that conversation with at least two other people. And, you know, what's going on is, although most of our mosquitoes overwinter as eggs, there's one group, the Culex, that overwinter as adults. And you find them in caves and tree holes. We even see them in basements at times on the basement wall, just kind of hanging low. And so, yes, it's very, very possible. And, you know, I know historically when we've been blessed with those 60-degree days in January, I've had people who have been outside and had the same phenomena as to walk in the woods enjoying the weather, and lo and behold, looks what shows up. So that would be as good a guess. If you didn't bring the firewood in, then we'd be kind of scratching a little bit as the potential source. But
firewood, and then they can live, well, they get under the bark or whatever, I suppose.
Yeah, basically, you know, like the spiders, everybody says dormant. You know, the critical thing seems to be about 50 degrees. Below 50 degrees, everybody's kind of on hold, and above that, when you warm them up, they can wake up.
Turning next to, by the way, we've got open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234 as we visit about the insects we're floating around here, even in the wintertime. Rick in Milwaukee, you're next. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I noticed on our white walls, a bug just kind of on the wall, about the size of a half dollar in diameter. And it looks exactly like a mosquito. But again, it's huge. Oh, maybe like a quarter, maybe the size of a quarter. And they're really easy to kill, and I never saw it fly. But there were about three of them. One, and a week later, there was another one, and another one, another, and about a week later, there was another one. And the thing is, I brought some plants in, some herbs from the summer, and I didn't bother looking at them very much, so I just brought them in. So maybe that has something to do with it. Was that a mosquito, a huge mosquito, or was it something else?
Well, what I suspect when I hear of critters that look like very, very large mosquitoes is we have an insect called a crane fly, which doesn't have the biting mouth parts that a mosquito does, but they do look rather intimidating because of their large size. And those insects are typically associated with very damp conditions. You can find the larvae and rotting logs out in the woods and that kind of thing. But it's possible if you had some potted plants that you brought in and that soil had been kept moist, there's a chance there could have been some larvae in there, and that could be the source of the insects.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have to worry about them in the house, do I?
No. No, they're not going to bite. They're just primarily a nuisance. They'll fly around. So either, you know, take them out with a piece of paper toweling, or if you saw several of them, haul out the hose attachment to the vacuum cleaner.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what was the name of that insect again?
A crane fly.
C-R-A-N-E?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hey, thank you a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Limey, our lime tree, we bring that in every fall, and usually about this time of year. Actually, it was a couple weeks earlier. Some white, I think they're white flies, come out, and I think they're probably sitting in the soil until they hatch, the eggs hatch or something.
Or that one, I'd even be suspicious. You just brought a couple in, and you're in about the third generation now, and they're finally getting numerous to get your attention, because white flies will keep pushing all the time if the temperature allows it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm surprised I didn't. I always know when there's something, an insect of any kind in the house, because the cats are instantly, I mean, they're hunting. And they're alert. Oh, boy. We had caller Eric say, we were talking about the insects that could be in, you know, come out of your body. While they don't live in Wisconsin, the botfly, Eric says, will burrow under the skin and then do nasty things once they get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I never thought, you know, when I was a student and heard about the human botfly, never thought I would experience that live and in person. But honestly, over the years, we did have a handful of samples come in. But it's always people who have traveled. But the thing about that, it's a very large creature. You know, it almost is a tumor-like wound that you get. So as I said, it's not as innocent. So, but yeah, he's right. I guess it just doesn't come to mind, because it's not something, unless you've been traveling to Mexico or whatnot, you would be exposed to.
John in Bayport, Minnesota, our next caller. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I started a large garden last year at 65 feet by 52 feet. Did not find an earthworm at all of my killing. How do you attract earthworms to a garden?
Well, the first thing I'll tell you, and you know, this is kind of, I think, been a kind of a conceptual change for a lot of us, is that earthworms are not native to the northern Great Lakes, and they are considered an invasive species. And although in the garden we can say all kinds of nice things about what they do, if you read into it, you find out that when earthworms get into our woodlots and whatnot, they are causing a major ecological shift. And so, you know, if you can keep them contained. But that may be part of the explanation, is you're far enough north or far enough isolated. So all the earthworms that we're seeing have somehow been brought in, and as I said, in some cases are not so much in the garden, but when they get out in the woods, there's a concern.
Also, we have a bunch of crabapple trees out there, and we get those big spiderweb branches, one branch filled with all the spiderweb.
Yeah.
I've been told there are earthworms, but I don't know, and is it something to worry about?
Are you seeing the spiderweb-like tents in the spring or in the fall or late summer?
Late summer.
Late summer. In that case, we have a critter called the fall webworm, which tends to make these kind of silken tents that look very much like a spiderweb, and they're often out towards the tips of branches. And they can feed on a number of tree species out there, and they tend to pop up usually in late July and August. And I had quite a few calls in the diagnostic lab last year about that particular critter.
Like I say, they're not used for harvesting or anything. Is that something to worry about? Let them go.
The fall webworm?
Yeah. Should we cut that off or branch off? Or?
Well, no, I don't think you need to go to any extremes like that. If they are doing an awful lot of damage to the trees, there are a number of contact sprays that we can use. There are some BT products that we can use and can be effective to control them. But usually we don't need to go out and start really pruning back our trees if there's just a couple of tents around.
Okay, good. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And BT, of course, Bacillus thuringiensis, which is considered organic.
Yeah, it's a naturally occurring bacteria that happens to produce some proteins that are toxic to insects. And so there are certain products out there that are available, but you have to pick and choose the correct ones. A lot of the strains we see work only against caterpillars. Mm-hmm. And so if you're trying to control fungus gnats, you need to choose the correct strain for those critters. So,
Tanya in Stevens Point. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. So I was a question about diamaceous earth.
Yeah.
And I seem to, you know, put that kind of out. Really, really helped on the strawberries and seems to help with ticks. But now am I killing too many things with that? Or, I mean, is it relatively safe? And somebody said you can even put it on the dogs, but I would think the dust itself would be hard on their lungs. What do you know about that? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you picked up the lung thing. So it's basically very similar to sand when you get down to it. It's the same chemical, but it's very sharp edges to it. In a way, it kills insects is to abrade the surface. And I always tell people, you can kill any insect in the world with diatomaceous earth if you put it in a jar with diatomaceous earth, because it has to crawl around and get hurt. But outside, it really is less effective because it gets diluted, it gets blown away and the like. And so for the dog part of it, the problem is if you get, you know, these fine grains in your lungs, it can cause some problems. In fact, it's interesting, is back in the day, they used to put it in seed packs to keep stored product insects out, but they found that the workers that were associated with that were starting to develop lung issues, and so they don't do that anymore. So it definitely has its uses, but as I said, to me, it's more an indoor type of or a confined situation. In fact, in some parts of the country, it would be appropriate to use this, or there's a silica aerogel, which is just a synthetic version of this, that if you blew in your walls, you would insect-proof your house, because anything crawling the walls would be abraded, but we have it contained. Whereas, I said, the problem outside, it gets diluted, it gets washed away, and so even though it's got a lot of uses, you got to be a little careful with it, I think.
And there is, there actually is a form of it that is can be taken by humans. You can actually, if you have... Yeah.
Well, I would assume that they've given it to cows, although I know the research on cows is maybe not as medicinal as people think, but it's...
We got into this the other a week ago when Dr. Sandy Sawchuk was on from the School of Vet Medicine, and I made a comment about, well, I would never take any diatomaceous earth. Well, I got lots of emails after the fact upbraiding me for...
Yeah, I heard you could put it in your dog's water.
Yeah, well, I'd be careful about which one. You want to make sure that you have...
Sure, it's the food grade.
Yeah, you want the food grade.
Yeah. So there's a particular malady that they were using this for as far as medicinal?
Worms
or
something.
Kind of preventative?
Yeah, it was worms. Some sort of... Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, there are formulations that are very effective on bed bugs, but... You know, the difference is, again, formulation is that if you buy the garden stuff and sprinkle it in a house that has bed bugs, it really is not very effective. The formulations they're having the best luck with are very fine particles, and they literally put a very light coating on. And so this is one of those cases, if you're interested, I think you got to do more research and make sure you've got the right stuff, because just diatomaceous earth, per se, they even use it as pool filters. I mean, it has a lot of different uses, and you got to make sure you've got the right grade for what you use.
Yeah.
Wow, great.
Yeah, thanks, Danya. Appreciate the call. Heather in Milwaukee, hello to you. Thank you for calling.
How are you?
I'm doing
hello.
Great. I hope you're doing well.
Me too. I'm calling about some bites I got this fall. And the first one, I didn't really feel it. It was on my back. And a week later, I was in the shower, and I had like an infection. And then the first... second bite I got, I noticed it right away, and what happened is it was like a blister, like just a water-filled blister, and then it became completely infected. It took like a month and a half for it to heal. I have a scar on my back, and I was moving some furniture down in the basement, and I just don't know, is it a spider? Is it some? Am I hypersensitive to spider bites, or I don't know.
Heather, my first thought is that it probably isn't a spider. If you dig into the literature, it turns out that spiders just really don't bite people all that often. Now, if you had one in an article of clothing and you smush it against your skin, then it might bite defensively, but really they don't go out of your way or out of their way to bite people. And especially if someone is experiencing multiple bites, that just isn't a type of pattern that we see and associate with spiders. Now, there are a lot of times that folks can get some kind of skin rash, and maybe it develops into a large sore, and spiders can get blamed for it, but it turns out that in a lot of cases these are other causes. It might be some type of bacterial infection, and if it's a case like that, I mean, you really need to see a physician and have them sort through what the ultimate cause might be.
Yeah, well, it happened in, like, 3 months, you know? So I was moving a desk from the basement up to the... And I felt something pinch on my shoulder, and then I felt a blister. And I thought, well, hey, you know, I just pinched it moving this desk, and it's a little blood blister. And then just the other one was on the back of my calf, so it was just so random, you know?
Yeah.
I did have a doctor look at pictures, and she thought maybe I was having shingles, but no, it didn't hurt. There was no pain at all, actually. So,
well, and a tricky thing is... It's very difficult to look at a sore or a suspected bite and tell what the cause is. If there was someone out there that could look at something and right away confirm it was a spider bite or bacterial infection, that would be great, and that would make life much simpler. But unfortunately, we have to go and gather clues and have physicians start sorting through all the different things that could potentially be going on.
And we often reference people that... The best reference I've ever seen, there's a person out in California, Dr. Rick Vetter, and he's published extensively on what spiders can and can't do. And I often suggest people to go to Rick's site. But the one thing he had picked up is so often, what always bothered me when I was running the lab is I get all these cases of people saying they were bit by brown recluse and they never found the spider. They diagnosed it by the symptoms. But when Rick started digging, half the cases of recluse bites, quote, were in states where you can't find the spider. Well, that doesn't make sense. And through his research, he found a lot of that were staph infections, you know, because they look very similar a week later when you go in the emergency room because you've got this open sore. And so, as I said, he's tried to get some common knowledge in on this. And the bottom line is he's found is that in a lot of cases, even what we thought were spider bites turned out to be
staph infections,
and MRSA in particular, because it presents in a very similar manner. And, and of course, those can get quite serious. So it's definitely worth, you know, consulting a physician and getting a follow-up. But and then so there's also in this conversation, can spiders carry bacteria on their chelicerae that they bite with? And I think Rick just got a recent paper out, and basically, again, that's kind of showing there really isn't a whole lot going on there. So as I said, in a lot of cases, we're finding that the spiders get blamed for something they're not responsible for.
There you go, Heather. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And caller was surprised that PJ and Phil did not mention Lyme's disease when the topic of ticks came up. This is what the caller is saying here. Maybe you can mention or say a word or two about the ticks that carry it.
Sure. So that one is transmitted by our deer tick, which can be fairly common throughout the state. And it does typically, or in many cases, give you this distinct bullseye-like rash. So it is the deer tick that transmit that particular disease.
Yeah. And the interesting thing to watch change is when this first was unfolding, I think we often, when they were sampling the tick populations, it was like 10-15% of the adults were carrying the disease. To be honest, in many sites in the state now, it's closer to 40%. So one of the reasons we see an increase is because of the higher percentage of ticks that are carrying. And then the other side is, you know, the tick has become far more numerous and widespread in the state in the last 20 years than it was back when we first started picking it up in the northwest part of the state.
Talking about insects today with Phil Pelletieri and P.J. Leash from the University of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network as we talk the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate at the UW-Madison. At one point, and for a long, long time, headed the Insect Diagnostic Lab until his retirement. The guy who handles it, that job right now is P.J. Leash, who has a degree in biological sciences, another in also entomology from the UW, manages the lab now, and also involved with the Master Gardener program, among other things. He's got his finger in a lot of pies. Great to have them both with us today as we talk insects. And John in Weston's been waiting a bit, so let's go right to John. Thank you for waiting, John.
Hey, no problem. How you guys doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Good. Hey, I appreciate you taking it. When I bought a house last year, there were some little black ants. Well, actually, big black ants, which I figured were carpenter ants, and they turned out that they were. And I had a pest control place. They said they'd need to, you know, come out monthly and, you know, not fumigate, but spray and set traps and stuff. So they did that. After the winter, like right at the first thaw, a few started coming back. I haven't seen them again this year, but I'm wondering if I need to keep this pest control service out. I think I may have eradicated them, but I'm not sure what to do next because my contract is up this month.
Okay.
Well, if you haven't seen them in a while, that could indicate that the treatments had gotten them. And when it comes to ant control, like carpenter ants, if you can simply find the nest, life is good because you just need to spray it a couple times with Raid, and that'll get the job done. But when they're hidden, and they can hide pretty well, they're associated with soft wood, so it could be a wall void where there was a leaky pipe, for example, and a little bit of water damage. But in other cases, if you don't see them during the winter, and they start showing up once it's warmer in spring, then I start thinking about a nest that is outside, perhaps in a rotten tree in the yard or in the neighbor's yard, and they can wander around and get indoors, and they're looking for food in a case like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you mention that because I have a boulevard tree that's a Norwegian maple, and it's splitting, and we found some in there, so my guy treated that area. And then the city came out and did a treatment on the tree. So I'm wondering, it's out in the front yard, but I found these, you know, in my house. But I think that may have been the source for them. I couldn't find them anywhere else.
Yeah.
One of the things that when people are giving a history, and you know, PJ and I both like to get the history of where the ants have been doing because it helps us. So any ants at this time of the year, aside from nesting in the house, to me have to be nesting away from an outside wall because it's too cold. If you were to say you saw the first ants on the 15th of March, it probably isn't going to be warm enough outside for the outside ants to be active. So that suggests a wall or a nest in a wall or an attic space that is just starting to warm up in the light because the outside ants. Now, where it gets really confusing for all of us is when you see them in the summer because even with your treatment, don't be alarmed to see a couple ants in the kitchen in the summer because there could be a neighbor's tree that's infested.
Yeah.
In fact, the argument is every property that's got trees has got carpenter ants somewhere. And so it's more this pattern that suggests, yeah, they're just some wandering in from outside because it's the summer, or no, they're nesting indoors. And so I think it's reasonable to stop service and wait and see what happens.
All right. And then if they do appear again, is there anything you would recommend I use to treat them?
Well, I think what we're seeing, a change in technology is, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't have any baits for carpenter ants. Now there are baits available, so some companies will go with that, with the concept the females will, or the queens will eventually be exposed to the baits that the workers bring back. It gets a little tricky because the ants don't always accept the baits. There are some other treatments that can only be applied by pest control people, not on the inside, but the outside. There's a product called Termidor that many pest control services will use. And the interesting thing about this product is when the ants crawl through it, they literally pick up enough. It's not a bait, but they pick up enough that they can bring it back to the nest and poison a nest that can be even 100 yards away. So this has been kind of the direction that many of the companies have went to, is using the Termidor treatment because they really don't need to know where the ants are. And that's why, as they said, it'd be worth talking. It sounds that the person's trying to do you a good job because, again, if he's hunting down nests that are in a tree, he's trying to get to the source of the problem.
Yeah.
And from his perspective, he's looking for a happy customer, so he's trying to stop you from seeing ants the best way he can.
Yeah.
But I don't think in most cases that monthly service for years is required. Because, as I said, there are other ways to solve this problem, and your concern is the ants nesting in the house, and
yep,
you know,
right,
that may have been taken care of.
There you go.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for the info.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate the call. And Lily in Platteville, appreciate your call. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have another ant question. Mine is in regard to, I think they're called field ants. They leave the big mounds out in your yard or whatever.
Yeah.
And I had listened to a previous program where you had said to pound some holes down and pour 7 in them. The problem is I probably have about 40 of them in our yard. It used to be CRP, and it's also clay, so it's really hard to work with and really... we did a couple anthills, but trying to pound into clay didn't work very well. Mm-hmm. I also tried some diatomaceous earth on, and that didn't seem to do anything. And someone had suggested, I think on one of your shows, putting cream of wheat or cornmeal on top of them, and I think I just fed them when I did that.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been PJ or I. I know that
no.
You see on the
no,
internet.
No, it was someone who had called in and said they did that, and you didn't say it would work or anything. They just, you know, but anyway.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, this is an ant that hasn't lent itself to baiting very well, and even the baits that are available don't work. So, you know, I don't think that's the direction to go. It is just kind of a spot and treat. And the biological frustration is there's a queen down in the ground, and if you kill her, you solve the problem. If you don't kill her, you still have an ant colony that can last for years. So it's, as I said, unfortunately, you have to spot treat every nest, I think, in order to be very effective.
Okay. So... All right. I guess I was looking for something a little easier than trying to drill into clay, but okay.
There you go.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Kevin in Madison. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have I'm torn between two questions, so I'm just going to throw them both out there, and you're welcome to address either or both. The first one is just how to treat a little 5-acre farmette that we have 3 kids on for ticks. Every once in a while we'll find a tick on them, and we try to do regular tick checks. We've toyed around with different sprays or getting some sort of animal. I think there's a certain sort of chicken or something that will eat the ticks, and just letting them free range. That's the first question, how to control the ticks on this little 5-acre hobby farm. The other one is we have a enormous amount of box elders and ladybugs infiltrating the south side of our house. And we just kind of vacuum them up, but it seems like an endless task. And we just wanted to know if there are any other solutions to kind of stop them from coming inside and reproducing.
Sure. Well, let's go with the second part of that question first, Kevin, about the box elders and lady beetles that are getting in. So those are both species that like to sneak indoors in the fall, and they're basically looking for a spot to spend the winter. So if they get into a wall void or undersiding, they'll just hunker down and spend the winter. But if the wall void is warm enough, they can become active, and then all of a sudden they show up in a room, maybe on the southern face of the house or a sunroom where it's rather warm. The ultimate solution would be to look at the outside of the house, because these critters have to get in somehow. And so if there are gaps around the edges of siding, for example, perhaps we can seal those up with caulk or expanding foam, look around door frames, window frames, soffit areas. And as I mentioned, if we fill up those gaps and physically prevent them from getting in, that's going to be the ultimate solution. Now, in some cases, if you have an older farmhouse and there's too many holes and we just can't do that, there are some treatments available that a pest control company can come out, and they spray it later in the year, usually in September or so, to create a chemical barrier to deter the insects from getting in. But once they're inside the house, there isn't much you can do about them other than haul out the vacuum cleaner and suck them up.
Mm. Now, the tick thing gets kind of ticklish, because it's the amount of area that you've got to treat. You know, we tell people that areas that you mow and keep the grass short is very hostile to ticks. You don't expect them to hang out there. But when you start to get where there's leaf litter and longer grass, that's where the ticks do well. And there is a bunch of sprays, including even soapy water sprays, that potentially can be effective. But the research out east tells us that you have to put so much pressure, you basically have to drive your product into the stuff, and you know it's kind of like a hurricane machine. And most people don't have that kind of equipment. They're just going in there with a little hand sprayer. And so with 5 acres, as I said, yes, conceivably, if you had the right equipment, you could put it in and affect it, but I don't think it's practical. So I think much as you're doing is have those safe areas, and then kind of have the rule, if the kids are getting out into the longer grass, we had talked about the clothing protections that are out there that are very effective. And this way, at least the ticks aren't going to have an opportunity to feed long enough to cause any kind of problems. But said it's just too big an area. You know, in state parks, sometimes they will, you know, they'll both mow a trail and they'll spray just the edge of the trail, you know, maybe 3 or 4 feet in. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to reduce the contact between ticks and people. But if the kids are out playing or your dog's out running out in the woods, it just isn't practical.
Yeah.
Again, you can mow things, you can dry it up, you can rake. That's going to help in the long run, but I'm just not sure you're going to get things barren enough to make it tough for the ticks.
And guinea fowl are probably the birds you were probably thinking about. Yeah. As very efficient insect eaters, but also they are awfully noisy.
Yeah. And great coyote food. I think that's the problem. It's even if you try to do it right, I'm not sure they're going to last long enough to get you where you want to go.
And they're noisy. I have first-hand experience of that back when I was a much younger guy, and they're not a whole lot of fun when they get yakking. But they do. They are. I mean, that's what they just sit and eat insects all day. So.
Yeah, and people tell me that they have chickens. Say, you know, they could a good job locally of foraging around, but they're not going to be walking around the whole 5 acres. So.
No. There you go.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin, for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Doug and Amory. He's had a jug of 10% permethrin that he got at the local farm supply store for fall application on his house for clusterfly and box elder bug control, and wondering what concentration could he use on his clothes for tick control. I don't know if I'd want to fiddle around with that.
Well, it's a legal problem. So even though it's the same active ingredient, and if you look to find, I think a lot of the sprays are 0.5%, it is not legal to use a pesticide in a manner that's different than the label allows. And I get into this in some of the, you know, I like to bow hunt, so I get in these hunting forums and I hear the same thing. I can go to the tractor supply and buy the concentrated stuff. And as I said, it's risking. There's different carriers. Don't do it.
Don't do it. Talking with Phil Pelletieri and PJ Leash today about insects. They'll be with us right up till 12:30. You stay with us. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, no matter what the season. Always lots of insects around, and whether we're talking about wasps or butterflies or snow fleas or spiders, really it's fascinating and informative conversation. When we have Phil Pelletieri, for example, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. And Phil, always great to see you.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, and as well, we've got joining us for the first time, PJ Leash. PJ took over the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab after Phil's retirement, and it's great to have him with us today as well to talk about what you guys are finding out there in the world of insects. So give us a call at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page for that. And some interesting questions coming up here, I think. Lisa and St. Germain up next. Lisa, hi.
Hi. Occasionally, I find it's a tiny little bug that looks almost like a tick, a little flatter, but it's got these two front claws that look like crab claws, but it's really tiny, tiny, minute.
Okay, well, what it sounds like is a critter that we call a pseudoscorpion. And if you were to look at a picture of a scorpion but shrink it down in size and take the tail off of it, that kind of summarizes what you just described. They do have these kind of large crab claws on the front of their body, on their forelegs, and they tend to be pretty small sized, maybe a 16th of an inch long, 1/8 inch long, something like that. The common species we see has a whitish body with some reddish claws on them. They're harmless to humans. We do see them around homes, and they're actually predators of other critters that we see around the home. So, you know, if they really frighten and scare you, you can always get rid of them. Otherwise, it might just be best to leave them be and let them munch on any other critters that might be around the house.
Yeah.
Oh, they don't scare me at all. They're too small. But what do they usually prey on?
Any kind of other small insect that's around the house.
I think you find them on ants. I've seen them very good at eating carpet beetle larvae. And, of course, carpet beetles occasionally will put a hole in your sweater. So as PJ said, it's something that if you can tolerate, they're good to have. And you never get overrun, although I did have one case, never could figure it out. It was up in the Fond du Lac area where people could easily see four or five a day continuously, and the poor pest control service was doing everything they could think of, and they still couldn't get the numbers down. And even to this day, I can't explain why they had such a large population. I mean, it just doesn't add up. But typically, they're very secretive, hunt at night, so you don't see them most of the time. So
I've only seen them maybe a half a dozen times in 10 years. So.
Fascinating. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks a lot for calling. BJ Leish and Phil Pelletieri here on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Oakwood Village University Woods, a locally owned and operated nonprofit retirement community offering a full continuum of care and services located on Madison's west side. More at oakwoodvillage.net. Support also comes from Madison Gas and Electric, working to meet the growing energy needs of our community through a mix of resources while helping customers protect the environment through conservation. Energy topics are available at mge.com.
Taking some more calls now. You can join in again at 800-642-1234. Helen in Price County up next. Hi, Helen. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question about spiders. And I've got spiders in the basement that they look somewhat like a daddy long legs, only they have a little tiny body on them like a grain of rice, maybe, the body itself. I was wondering what to do with them, how to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, Helen, from what you described, it sounds like a critter that we call a cellar spider. Cellar as in basement, because we often see them in basements, in garages, and they tend to make webs in the corners of rooms. Now, if you can tolerate them, they're predators, so they're feeding on any other insects that might be wandering around the house. Otherwise, if you want to get rid of them, it might just be simplest to take either a broom or a hose attachment on your vacuum cleaner and go to the corners and suck them up.
Well, these tend to go across the basement. When you walk down there, you get them in the webs in your face even.
Okay. Yeah. In certain spots, you know, they'll make some pretty good-sized webs.
Yeah. They're not poisonous. They're not anything that's going to bite you or anything like that.
No, but I think you find most people, it's that spring housekeeping type of thing. You get in there and suck them all up, and you will see, and they will never go away. You will always have them eventually build back, but it should last for months if you put that kind of effort into it. But get back in those corners, as PJ said, because it's, you know, they're notorious for kind of hiding out, but yet the webs are everywhere. And I don't think there's a basement we have in the state that doesn't have some cellar spider webs. And there's a long-bodied species and a short-bodied species. You know, that's kind of for us to play with, but definitely nothing to worry about.
There you go. Thanks, Helen, for calling. John in Sun Prairie, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. We just recently discovered a carpenter ant nest, and we think we know where the nest is now. It's under a shower that we now know is not watertight, and so we think one of the joists is moist. And so I have two questions. If we remove the wet wood, the moistured wood, the joist, when we repair the shower, should that take care of the problem? Or if there are still some eggs that are in the vicinity that we don't get or something, will they be able to mature on their own, or do they need the worker ants, the worker carpenter ants to provide for them?
Well, yeah, this solution probably is going to be just get rid of the wood. They cannot. They're totally dependent on the workers to feed them and care for them. So, as I said, that's why we don't worry about it. Back when I first started, people used to be misled with that, you know, if we don't get the eggs, they're going to hatch and give you a nest in a few weeks. It doesn't work that way. You know, I think the one thing that I've seen with carpenter ants, and this, again, was, I think, a learning experience from when I first started, but they go through this phenomena in the summer where the colonies out in the big trees and whatnot will send out satellite colonies. So you can have what we would call a seasonal ant colony, but that satellite does not have a queen, and they're basically moving into things. And so sometimes I think the frustration people have is, you know, they see the ants and then they go away, and they see the ants and go away, or they even treat the ants in one spot thinking they solved the true nest, and it isn't the true nest, it's a satellite. So makes it a little frustrating, but it's a common behavior of those ants. And I think
so we probably have a satellite nest
no,
from
No, if you've got ants active now, there is a main colony with a queen in the house. It's not a satellite. The satellite is a summer issue.
Oh, so no, we do. I'm seeing ants every day.
All right. Yeah, no, and so in this time of the year, what we find, I think, is they're not even that interested in food. These ants that are kind of waking up because it's warm and they think it's spring, I find they're often near a source of water. And I think what we speculated is they're trying to pick up the water, bring it back to the nest to start to get the humidity up in the nest so that the queen can start laying eggs and it's easier to raise young. So any ant, even one or two ants at the bathroom sink or whatnot at this time of the year, the only explanation is there is a colony, a true colony, nesting in the structure somewhere.
So we do have a queen in there, and so we got to get that piece of wood out, right?
Yes.
Yep.
You know, and as we've talked on the show before, we shouldn't have called them carpenter ants. I mean, because the common concept is they eat wood, and they don't. They nest in soft substrates, styrofoam, and again, and PJ and I have seen them in hollow core doors and sometimes just void spaces. And a lot of times I think those are satellite colonies that are just taking advantage of things. But a common place is where there at least has been a history of water damage where the wood is soft enough that they can excavate it. Just like out in the trees, you see them in rotten wood. You do not see them doing much in sound wood. They don't think they have the jaws are capable of doing a whole lot in sound structural wood.
There you go.
So even if we miss the queen, if we they're not going to be able to survive in solid wood. They have to have moist wood.
Right. Although, you know, an interesting thing, PJ and I were up at a conference this weekend, a pest control conference, and somebody was presenting some data. And, you know, we typically don't think carpenter ants can relocate very well. But on occasion, a nest can relocate. And it's just a case, can they find another void space to move into? So, you know, you learn in science never to say never. But generally what you've got planned is you got bad wood, you're going to replace it when you open it up. That's going to be the solution.
Yep, there you go. Good luck, John. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Jackie in Milwaukee a chance to join in. Jackie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, bless your heart. You still walking in the morning?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you're strong. I've got a quick question and then a nut. Did taxidermists ever use carrion beetles to clean bones? But the question I want to know is, a friend asked me, Phil had mentioned something the last time he was on, that they found something that might work against bed bugs. And do bed bugs bite your pets?
Hmm. All right.
Well, let's start with the first question about the taxidermist. It's not the carrion beetle. There is another family of beetles, the family Dermestidae, which we commonly call hide and carpet beetles. And we do have a species that people will use for scientific purposes. You can put in the skeleton of an animal in there, for example, and the beetles basically clean the bones. So then we have a nice cleaned-off skeleton, and researchers can put it into a museum. So that's a topic on that one. When it comes to the bed bugs, there was some rather interesting news that came out late around the time of Christmas last year. Some researchers in Canada have been studying the chemicals associated with bed bugs, looking for the pheromones. And so it seems like they found some pheromones that attract bed bugs and then cause them to stay put, an aggregation pheromone. And so the potential implications for this are huge because they are working on designing some traps that we can put out as monitoring devices to detect bed bugs when they're present in very, very low numbers. And so it would be a great monitoring tool to have, because when it comes to bed bugs, if you catch them early, it's a lot easier to deal with them than if you wait until the populations are huge and then you have a nightmare. And if you're in an apartment building, they spread to other units or other rooms in the home. Yeah, it's just a mess.
Yeah. One of the other things that just came out that's very fascinating. So, you know, a lot of people have been looking for less toxic ways to control bed bugs. And we know that there's lots of natural plant oils that if you spray on the bed bug, you can kill them. But the dilemma has been is that these products have not had any residual, so if the bed bug crawls on it later, it's not affected. Well, there was an interesting combination. I think the people in New Jersey that have been doing research, and it is sodium lauryl sulfate, which is kind of a shampoo-like base, geraninol, I think, and there was one other component. But interesting enough, this combination they put together in this particular formulation was performing as well as many of the residual insecticides, but yet all these other combinations didn't. And so this is one where I think it's very encouraging we're finding some other avenues. But interesting enough, the people that have formulated this are not releasing what the secret of their formulation is. I can understand that. But so it will be a stay tuned, but you've got to be very careful because, as I said, just because it's a natural plant oil, as I said, there's only been this one combination that seems to be able to hold up and have the kind of performance that we would like to see, whereas all the other combinations, and we don't understand why yet. I'm sure they will figure that out eventually. But
Do they bite your pets?
Yes. They really don't seem to be successful in if your pets were the only meal, they would not be successful in breeding. I remember our colleague down in the University of Florida that's done a lot of work with bed bugs. He raises them on chickens. He said, we tried to raise them on rats, but they killed the rats. Ah. You know, and they weren't successful in doing that. So there is an association. They seem to do well on birds, which is historically where bed bugs come from. And we do know they bite pets, but it does not appear that that's an important component to what they need to be able to reproduce.
Huh. Very good. Jackie, did we get you? I think we answered everything.
Oh, yes.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
As always.
Appreciate your call. Jackie calls every once in a while. It's always great to hear her voice. And John in Madison, looking forward to hearing your voice. Hi.
I've got a question and a comment. My question is, I get these little tiny red ants in summer in my kitchen, and they only seem to appear at night, and then they're in the daylight, they're gone. But they come by the thousands, and I have something called Terra or something like that, that within a couple of days, they're all dead. And then they might appear one more time in the summer. But I also, right outside that window, I have bluebirds and lots of nice birds, and I don't want to poison them, and I don't know if they ever get at these ants or not, and if they do, is there something better I could use? And my comment is about the ticks. I feed the birds in the backyard, and there's some high grass there, and in the spring when the grass is still up, I'll get anywhere from 3 to 5 ticks every time I go to fill my bird feeder. So I started burning it. And ever since I started burning it once in the spring, I don't get any ticks at all. And that's my comment. But my question was about those little red ants.
Yeah.
Okay, well, a little hard to tell for sure what they are because we have a lot of different types of ants. And especially during the summer, a number of them can try to sneak indoors. Now, I know Phil has talked plenty of times on the show before about ants and their different taste preferences. Sometimes you put out a given bait, such as taro, and they just don't want to have anything to do with it. And so an important thing to dealing with ants is picking a bait that they seem to like and go after, and then that does the job for you. Now, in terms of effects to birds, in general, I suspect there probably wouldn't be too much of an effect. So the chemical that is in these ant baits, it's usually a version of boric acid, and it's the same or similar chemical that's in borax soap. So in general, it's a chemical with rather low toxicity. It's a stomach poison for the ants. So they have to ingest it and then share it with other ants in the colony, and then the colony tends to die out.
Yeah, the only time I've ever seen problems, honestly, is in zoos, where both ants and cockroaches are sometimes, they use baits to control them. And because it was a closed environment, in fact, again, this when this stuff was first coming out, even though the products themselves aren't that toxic, nobody kind of thought the birds would be exposed to it because they're in the these little bait traps and the like. And they did get into trouble there. But we've got confined situations. It was more the cockroach baits, and it wasn't boric acid. It was some other active ingredient. So there are cases where, as I said, in those very specialized environments, you've got to be careful. But I just don't see the boric acid baits that are going to the birds will get any exposure. Now, your comment on the burning is very interesting. I do know of the short run makes a lot of sense. But back when Lyme disease was first unfolding, they were doing quite a bit of work out on the East Coast. And what they found is that in the long run, where you're burning every 3 or 4 years, they literally increased the amount of Lyme disease. And the association is in the short run, when you burned, you increase the rodent populations. When you increase the rodent populations, that had an effect on the tick population. So it's really quite interesting how intricate some of these things can be. But in a small scale, again, if you're burning at the right time, you're basically making a desert That's not what ticks need. They need some moisture, some protection, so I can see where it would be very effective.
Yeah. There you go, John. Thank you again for calling. And Wayne has a similar question here. Wayne, hi, from Milwaukee.
Hello, Larry. Yes, I have a question that relates to the person that you just talked to about ticks.
Yeah.
A little over a year ago, I bought a property up north between the towns of Mountain and Lakewood, and I've got like 2.5 acres of a meadow or field, whichever you want to call it, and my house is sitting on the edge of it. And anyway, my dog, right away, she likes to run from one end to the other. It's about 100 yards. And so she would collect wood ticks. And I also got a tick bite on my forearm and diagnosed as Lyme disease. And I had to go to the hospital in Anago. And I got they gave me a prescription to the drugstore, and it cleared it up right away because I got it right away. But anyway, I put Frontline on my dog, and in the morning sometimes by her bed in my bedroom, I'll find anywhere up to a half a dozen dead wood ticks. So I know that this stuff that I put on her is working. But is there anything I can do that I could put in the grass, you know, spread it out or something, some kind of a powder or anything like that that might get rid of some of these wood ticks?
Well, in general, no, because it sounded like you had a fairly good-sized plot of land with some meadow flowers and things like that. And so it's just you'd have to put out so much chemical to get rid of the tick numbers, and then if your dog runs off the property, they can grab ticks elsewhere. So it might be better just to go along the lines of making sure that you and your pets are protected in terms of things like Frontline. There are also some tick sprays that you can get. If you know that you have a lot of ticks in your area, you can get sprays at Farm and Fleet in other places that are intended to be sprayed onto dogs. And so that can provide...
Farm and Fleet?
A lot of other stores will have them.
Farm and Fleet.
Yep. Pet stores will usually have them. They contain ingredients such as permethrin and other things that Phil mentioned earlier for clothing. And so if I know that I'm taking my dogs, and I have two black labs, if we're going to a spot where there's a lot of ticks, we usually spritz them with this ahead of time just to help prevent the ticks from getting on, because the chemicals do have some repellent properties as well as to killing the ticks.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we have, I think we gave this earlier, but I think it bears doing again, because we've had people questioning, where do I send, if I've got a sample, where do I send that sample? And of course, we've been talking about the insect, UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and it's online. I mean, we can find it. If you just type in UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you're going to get it. But, you know, there are people who may not have computers or what have you. So where do we mail it?
So in that case, if you need the street address, it's 1630 Linden, is in a Linden Tree, L-I-N-D-E-N, Linden Drive, and it's room number 240. And that is, of course, Madison, Wisconsin, and the zip code is 53706.
So UW-Madison, care of you, PJ at UW-Madison, we're going to do it that way probably is all you need, 1630 Linden Drive, room 240, which is same office number I have, only in a different building, room 240, and Madison 53706, if I'm not mistaken, 53706. And so what do you guys think of that? What do you think, PJ?
This has been fun to be on here. I know Phil has always enjoyed being on the radio and chatting with folks, and I am enjoying the position so far. I love interacting with folks and taking insect questions, so it has been a blast, Larry.
That's wonderful.
And my comment to people is PJ is the new and improved Phil. So.
Well, Phil, you're always welcome. You know that.
Nice to be here.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus, our guest from UW-Madison. PJ Leash, our other guest, who now heads the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And I hope that we'll get these guys back and we can talk again. We have on tomorrow's show, we're going to take a look first at the Indian mounds of Wisconsin, the cultures that built them and how to interpret them. So that's going to be fun. And then we'll take a look at the Ice Age Trail. And that's always fun to talk about, even in the middle of winter. Well, in the middle of winter, you're not going to pick up any ticks on it, at least. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.